We'll take a look at an excerpt from the Mishnah in Perkei Avot. This is from Perkei Avot, chapter 2, where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was describing his students and giving particular attributes to each of them. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai would recount their praises. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is a pit covered in plaster that does not lose a drop. Alternatively, sometimes translated as a plastered cistern that does not lose a drop. Before we dive into the texts about Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus for today, let's just do a little bit of both reminding ourselves and idea generating. First of all, we said a plastered cistern who does not lose a drop. Some of the ideas we came up with of what that might mean is someone who absorbs everything that they have learned, someone who never forgets anything. When we talked about the strengths and weaknesses of such a person, we talked about the fact that such a person would be valuable in that they're a repository of information, but may have weakness in that they are not generative. They are not producing new ideas of their own. That's in contrast, of course, to the sage that we studied 2 weeks ago, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, who was described as an overflowing fountain. The plastered cistern simply absorbs, it does not generate. Let's take a moment before we dive into the two main texts that we'll be looking at today. I'd love for people to answer in the chat. What might lead someone to make a bet either for or against the plastered cistern model at this moment in history, in the wake of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, in the wake of the destruction of the temple, as we are attempting to essentially reconstitute Judaism? What might lead someone to say, yes, I am going to place my money on the plastered cistern model as being what we need to carry Judaism forward? Or what might lead someone to say, hey, you know what, actually, I don't think that is where our future lies. I don't think that I am going to gamble on the plastered cistern. I'll read some of the answers that came in the chat. Sarah Brooks says preservation is most important. Great. Susan Kaplan says maybe be sure not to lose anything of Judaism. Let's talk about this for a moment. There's something very poignant about this. There's the possibility that in the wake of destruction, what we want most to do is save as many pieces of the past as possible. There's one theory about legal codification of halakha throughout history that Jews as a civilization tend to create new legal codes, particularly after moments of destruction, and that we do it as a way of preserving memory and preserving what was almost lost. That's very different from moments of new generation of new halakha dealing with new questions, which we might feel more free to do in times of prosperity. I'll read some more answers. Mark Hochberg for remember everything that came before and he was taught, a rock solid foundation. As something is placed into a plastered cistern, nothing is lost and it can be retrieved exactly as it was put. The power of memory where nothing is lost. Okay, now we come to against. Against, no interpretation and new teachings. Sarah Brooks says, especially with the looming threat of Christianity, which I'm not sure which way that was leading, but potentially with new sort of alternative Jewish sects popping up, we might need to be able to generate new content of our own to stand in opposition. I'll read two more. Stephen Quill says, you want both. With the temple gone, the Jewish people need to reinvent themselves. Great. And Doreen Dabney says, a plastered cistern is one of experience, the hard spots and bumps of life. It is sustainable and trustworthy. It keeps being plastered to maintain it and can be. I want us to look for two things today. The first text we're going to look at is going to be a text that describes Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus as a plastered sister and really gives us a window into what sort of personality does someone need to have in order to be a plastered sister, or what sort of personality might give rise to a plastered sister. But the second text will be much more about what happens to the community that finds itself with a plastered cistern in its midst. And what we'll see, I think, in that second text is an inability of the plastered cistern and the rest of the community to live together. We'll come to that soon. Let's dive in to our first lengthy text. This is from the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Sukkah. Appropriately enough, because it begins with a scene that takes place on Sukkot. The sages taught, there was an incident involving Rabbi Eliezer, who stayed in the Upper Galilee in the Sukkah of Yochanan, son of Rabbi Elai, in Caesarea. And some say that it did not occur in Caesarea, but in Caesarion. And the sun reached a point over the roofing of the Sukkah, rendering it uncomfortable to remain in the Sukkah. I don't know how many of you have ever been in the Galil over Sukkot, but it can get unbearably hot. What we're talking about here, the sun reaching its zenith, is something more than what we living in America would ever usually call an uncomfortable Sukkot. This is blazingly, blazingly hot. That matters for the conversation that follows. He said to him, meaning, Yochanan said to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, what is the halacha? May I spread a sheet over the roofing? Is it permitted since it is only adding a temporary tent, or is it prohibited? Okay, let's make sure we understand what's going on. The sun is blazingly hot. The two people who are in the sukkah are Yochanan and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is the senior rabbi present. And Yochanan is trying to figure out a solution to this unbearable situation. He wants to spread a cloth over the top of the sukkah. But because it is Yom Tov, because it is a festival day, he has a question. Is this permitted or is this prohibited because it is similar to building? And he's waiting for Rabbi Eliezer to give him an answer. And let's remind ourselves, this is not the sort of thing where you want to wait around for a long time for an answer. It is growing hotter by the second. Rabbi Eliezer said to him, there is no tribe of Israel from which a judge did not emerge. Let's pause for a moment. If you are lost, you are lost for a good reason. It is as if I asked you, what should I put on the grocery list? I'm heading out to Key Food, that is the local supermarket where I live. And you said, when a bicycle gets jammed, it's very important to use WD-40 on the wheels. Nothing to do with the question that I asked. This would be, I might say, annoying under normal circumstances. It is even more annoying when I know that Key Food is closing in 10 minutes and I have to get there quickly, which is similar to the, it is 90 degrees and rising, I would really like an answer right now. Let's keep going. The sun reached over the midpoint of the roofing of the sukkah. He said to him, meaning Yochanan said to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, what is the halacha? May I spread a sheet over it? He's trying again. Rabbi Eliezer said to him, there is no tribe of Israel from which prophets did not emerge. The tribes of Judah and Benjamin were unique because they established kings according to prophets. Again, an answer that has nothing to do with the question. The sunlight reached the feet of Rabbi Eliezer. Yochanan took a sheet and spread it over the sukkah. Okay, the temperature is rising. Yochanan has had enough. He is no longer going to engage in this back and forth with nonsensical answers. He takes the sheet, spreads it over the sukkah. And what does Rabbi Eliezer do? Rabbi Eliezer slung his coat over his shoulder behind him and emerged from the sukkah. Why is he doing that? Because he clearly thinks that what Yochanan did in that moment is forbidden. He clearly had a halachic opinion. It is forbidden to put the sheet over the sukkah, but he was refusing to give Yochanan that answer. Why? The Gemara finally tells us. He did this, meaning he gave those unrelated answers, not to divert him, but because he never said a matter that he did not hear from his teacher. Okay, this is important. We've been talking about strengths and weaknesses of the plastered cistern. And this is a situation where we come to, if taken to the extreme, a pretty massive weakness. It is not that Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus does not have halachic opinions and ideas that he did not hear from his teacher. He clearly here thinks that the placing of the sheet over the sukkah was prohibited. He can do that sort of thinking internally, but he will only say things, he will only actively give rulings that he inherited from his teacher. Now, the situation of the sukkah, of course, locally, is relatively low stakes. But taken as a metaphor of we're in a situation where we need an answer and the temperature is rising, and if you don't give an opinion, someone is just going to eventually act. That gives us a real insight into a weakness of the plastered cistern. Tradition, at least if tradition is taken in its most literal sense, what have I heard, what has explicitly been discussed before, may not cover every new situation. He is a plastered cistern that does not lose a drop, but of course, even a plastered cistern cannot hold all the water in the world. There will be water that does not fall within its confines. And then we have to ask ourselves, what happens when we need that other water? Let's keep going. The sages taught. There was an incident involving Rabbi Eliezer who stayed in the Upper Galilee, and the people there asked him 30 halachot in the halachot of Sukkah. Regarding 12 of the halachot, he said to them, I heard. Regarding 18, he said to them, I did not hear. Rabbi Yossi, son of Rabbi Yehuda, says it was the reverse of these matters. Regarding 18, he said to them, I heard. And regarding 12, he said to them, I did not hear. Let's make sure that we are paying attention to the language here. He's not saying, I know the answer to this, or I don't know the answer to this. He is saying, I have heard the answer to this, or I have not heard the answer to this. All he is willing to impart is what he has explicitly heard. They said to him, are all the matters that you know only from what you heard? Meaning, are you just a plastered cistern? Is there anything else to you? He said to them, now you forced me to say a matter that I did not hear from my teachers. Okay, we're now moving past just the plastered cistern aspect of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus and getting to what else is in him. In all my days, no person ever preceded me into the study hall. And I never slept in the study hall, neither substantial sleep nor a brief nap. And I never left anyone in the study hall and exited. And I never engaged in idle conversation. And I never said anything that I did not hear from my teacher. Okay, let's pay attention to this. I want us to try to get a feeling of who is this person, personality-wise, if this is how he describes himself. If this is how he says, you want to know what I'm about? This is what I'm about. I was always the first one into the Beit Midrash in the morning, the first one into the study hall in the morning, and the last one out at night. I never fell asleep there, right? I think we have all seen this in classrooms at some point or another. Someone who has spent way too long in the library dozes off after a while. He's saying, that was never me. If there was anyone else left in the study hall, I was going to stay there as long as they were there. I didn't chit-chat with anyone. There was no idle conversation. And it's really important to me only to teach what I learned from my teachers. Let's pause for a moment. We've talked about what the advantages and disadvantages of such a person as a leader might be. But I want us to talk for a moment before we go into the next text about what do we think it would be like to be in community with this person? Why are we talking about that? Because as we saw last time with Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, we are looking at specific individuals as leaders, but they of course have fellow students and fellow rabbis. What do you think it would be like to work with such a person? What do you think it would be like to be in community with such a person, to be in a Beit Midrash with such a person? I'm going to ask people to put replies in the chat. Susan Kaplan says, I think it would be quite frustrating and I would look elsewhere for a teacher. Okay, great. If you're a student, there's going to be a lot that's difficult about that because sometimes you need to know if you can put the sheet over the sukkah. April Stern says it would be very linear, dry. Sarah Brooks says he did serve a purpose. He was a good resource to have around, but I'd hang out with the more fun people. Okay, great. Sarah Brooks is already looking at this and saying, well, can we find a place for him? Is there a way for all of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's limitations to say, okay, this is your spot within the community? You might not be my best friend, but I will figure out how to incorporate you into this Beit Midrash. Let's pay attention to that and come back to it. I'll read a few more. Deborah says, frustrating, but also trustworthy. You know he never makes stuff up because he felt like it. Great, that's really important. We'll come back to that next. And Leah Silberman says, I want a teacher, not a tape recorder. Okay, this is going to be really important. Let's hold those thoughts as we go on to the next text. The next text, I think many people here might have encountered in some form before. This is the story of the Tanur Shel Achnai, the Oven of Achnai. We're going to be looking at this story in two parts. The tone of the story shifts dramatically through as the story goes on. And as we go through this, I want us to be looking for two things. The first is, who is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus in this story? We know he's the plastered cistern. We know that he has certain limitations. What additional information do we get about him in this story? The second will be, I want us to look at the actions of his colleagues here. We'll see in this story, this is really a story in which Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is pushed out of the fold. I want us to pay attention to how his colleagues act towards him in this story, and I want us to ask ourselves, was there any other way for this to go? Could this story have had a different ending if different decisions were made? I'll tell you right now, I don't know that I have a firm answer to that question. It's part of what we'll be discussing over this session and the next. I'll also say I'm not certain that we'll get through this whole story today. We might do it in two parts. We'll see where we get. This is from, again, the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Bava Metzia. It was taught, if one cut an oven into sections and placed sand between every section, what is the ruling? Rabbi Eliezer rules it pure, and the sages rule it impure. This is the oven of Achnai. Okay, Talmudic stories are often introduced with a halachic question. We have a halachic discussion, and we're going to jump into the story based on that discussion. It is often very important to pay attention to what is the halachic question under discussion. The story is not just randomly tacked on to any halachic question. We have to look for, is there a metaphor here? Is there a theme here? Is there a meaning here? And to do that, we have to understand the halachic rules behind what makes an object susceptible to impurity or not susceptible to impurity. What does that mean? We often think in our day-to-day lives of course, pure is good, impure is bad. That's not necessarily how it works in the Talmudic canon. What does it mean in the Talmudic canon if you ask, if you say an object is susceptible to impurity? You mean it is a complete man-made object. Things only become susceptible to impurity once they are completely built. So what you're essentially asking when you ask, is this susceptible to impurity, is this a completed object or is it a jumble of parts? Let's pay attention to that. Why might that matter as we go into a story that is about, can this person remain in the community or not? Because what we are essentially asking is, as it stands, is a community that has this situation a complete community, or is it a jumble of parts, a jumble of people? And what is that situation? Let's take a look at the oven again. If it's cut into sections and sand is placed between each section, what might that mean on a community level? What happens when you have all of these people and there is friction between them? Is it indeed a complete object? Is it a community and thus susceptible to impurity? All that that means here is we think it can still be considered a community, or is it just a jumble of people? Rabbi Eliezer, interestingly here, says it's pure, meaning this is just a jumble. You have that sand in between, you have that friction in between, all you've got is a pile of individuals. And the sages say it's impure. The sages say, no, 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 that can still be a community. Let's pay attention. We'll come back to that metaphor at the end. What is achnai? Said Rabbi Yehuda in the name of Shmuel that they surrounded it with words of debate like an achnai snake and declared it impure. This is interesting, right? There's something a little almost sinister about the idea of the snake. They surrounded it with words of debate like an achnai snake and declared it impure. It almost feels like the sages who are the ones declaring it impure, it almost feels like there's an ambush waiting to happen here. And the truth is that ambush is not strictly for the oven, but potentially for Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Let's take a look. It was taught, on that day, Rabbi Eliezer answered all the answers on earth, and they did not accept it from him. Meaning, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus has given just about 100 different reasons why this oven should be declared pure. And the sages still won't listen. Let's just pause for a moment. Why might that be the case? Why might the sages be refusing to accept his ruling, even when he has given them just about 100 responses to any challenge that they bring? You can put replies in the chat. If you had to imagine, the storyteller obviously does not give us that information, but if you had to imagine or guess, why might that be? Okay, Sarah Brooks says they don't like his rigidity. Okay, let's take a look there. And Deborah says to preserve community. Paul Jenner, drawing from last text, says his answers are irrelevant to the current situation. Okay, good. Let's pay attention here. We begin to get the sense from the way that the storyteller is setting up the story that it may be that this is not so much about the halachic debate at hand, but about Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus himself. There is something potentially about Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus that the others are trying to shut down. Now, we do not know yet what that is. We can make guesses, of course. We can guess from the last text, well, he sounds like a difficult person to be around. Or they do not think that his halachic methodology is appropriate. Or there is something else about him that concerns them. I want us to hold off on making that decision so far. I think all we really know so far is that this is as much about Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus probably as it is about the oven. And the text, I think, will begin to show us parts of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's personality that give us more hints as to why. He said, "If the law is like me, the carob tree will prove it." The carob tree was uprooted from its place 100 cubits, and some say 400 cubits. They said, "We do not bring proof from a carob tree." Okay, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is doing something very unusual here, and that is he is turning to miracles as a sort of halachic proof. There's interesting background to this. As we'll see next week, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus seems to be practiced in some sort of rabbinic forms of magic. There's a lot to say there. We'll get that. We'll get there next week. But I think within this text, these are actually meant to be understood as miracles. The earth itself is showing that Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is in fact correct. And the question of what miracle does Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus choose to make his point is not arbitrary. Let's take a look at this. What does he say? He could choose anything. He could say, if the halacha is like me, let that bird that is standing on the windowsill turn from black to white. He could choose anything. What he chooses is, if it's like me, let the carob tree uproot itself. What sort of feeling does that give you? Why a carob tree proving it? Why a carob tree uprooting itself? What does that symbolize? Okay, Charlie Lewitt says, carob trees are long-lived. That's important. Carob trees are long-lived. They don't grow fruit until 70 years, at least Talmudically. I don't know botanically what contemporary carob trees are like. But they are long-lived, steady suppliers of easily preserved food. To uproot a carob tree is no minor thing. I think someone here used the language of destruction, right? Deborah says it's a violent uprooting of the tree that has sustained other sages. There's even potentially a little bit of wordplay going on here, right? In Hebrew, the word for carob is charuf, that shares a root with the word for destruction. There's something about this, I think, where we're meant to understand this is not simply a proof. This is a proof that might give us a lens into parts of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's personality. And I think that escalates. He came back and said, if the law is like me, the water channel will prove it. The water channel flowed in the reverse direction. They said, we do not bring proof from a water channel. Let's just pay attention for a moment to their response. Their response is, that's not how the game works, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. We are not interested in your miracles. We do not bring proof from a carob tree. We do not bring proof from a water channel. Of course, what's complicated here is it seems he already brought proofs that they rejected, more normal sorts of proofs. But what we have here is really a refusal to be impressed, a refusal to be moved by these sorts of divine interventions. Let's keep going. He came back and said, and I want us to pay attention here, if the law is as I said, the walls of the Beit Midrash will prove it. The walls of the Beit Midrash inclined to fall. Okay, let's pause for a moment. When I teach this text in a live classroom, I always ask, where do you think the sages are standing right now? People often will immediately say, well, they must be standing outside. Why? Because the image of them standing inside and the walls beginning to fall is horrifying. But in all likelihood, that is indeed where they are standing. They're probably standing within the walls of the Beit Midrash because that is where halakhic debates take place. Why does that matter? It matters because if we're asking the question of why have we come to this point? Why have we come to this point where there's an ambush set for Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus? Why have they come to this point where they feel like he can no longer be within the sort of normative halakhic community, which is where this is going? The answer might lie in, what is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus willing to do in the name of capital T truth, right? We know that capital T truth for Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus matters deeply. It is what he has inherited from his teachers. He feels that it is his fundamental responsibility in the world to relay that, and we can only imagine how emotionally laden that is in a world where so much of that tradition has been destroyed. We also get the impression here that he feels that that's a direct conduit to God, right? Why do you turn to miracles if the halakha is like what I'm saying? Then this will prove it, because you believe that God is fundamentally on your side. God is going to step in because you are arguing for the word of God as transmitted from God to Moses, to the chain of sages, through your teachers to you. And that is a beautiful thing. And we learn here that what is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus willing to do for that thing? He is willing, if needs be, to pull down the Beit Midrash itself with the sages inside of it. He is willing, in the name of truth and in the name of tradition, to actually destroy the tiny community of sages that is left. You'll see over this class and next that I have a soft spot for Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Obviously, this is an incredibly dangerous person. I also think he's a person who, if you can step inside his head, is easy, if not to empathize with, to sympathize with. How many of us have found ourselves in situations where the ideals we believe matter most are being pitted against, okay, and this is the community that we have. How can we make those two things live together? Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is unwilling to bend on the ideal. And that might mean that he is willing instead to destroy the reality. Let's take a look. He came back and said, if the law is like I say, the walls of the Beit Midrash will prove it. The walls of the Beit Midrash inclined to fall. Rabbi Yeshua protested at them, saying, if scholars defeat each other in the law, how does it benefit you? I love that reply. He's standing inside the Beit Midrash and the walls are caving in, and he's looking at the walls and saying, this is none of your business. We'll get more of a feel for Rabbi Yeshua over the coming weeks, but he is definitely a man with chutzpah, and he's definitely a man with a sense of humor. They did not fall because of the honor of Rabbi Yeshua, but they did not straighten because of the honor of Rabbi Eliezer. And still they incline and stand. Let's take a look here. There's something I think very important going on. Again, none of the Talmudic storytellers are very stingy with their words. If they bother to say the walls still incline and stand, they're trying to make a point there. What might the point be? What might be going on symbolically with these tilted walls? I think someone said it in the chat. The walls compromised. And Sarah Brooks says they're both right. Okay. The walls here are willing to do something that neither side is willing to do. They're willing to stand at an incline. They're willing to say we will neither fall because of Rabbi Yeshua, but we also won't go back to standing up because of Rabbi Eliezer. The walls are essentially here offering us a glimpse into another way. We asked ourselves, could this story have turned out differently? The walls at least seem to think possibly. There's also good reason to say maybe no. Maybe once someone has shown that they are willing to tear down the walls of the Beit Midrash around everyone within it, the Beit Midrash can no longer be a home for them. And maybe if the rabbis had not begun this day intent on an ambush, things never would have gotten to this point. We're left in a sort of conundrum. three different options, still not knowing, could this go differently? He came back and said, if the law's like me from the heavens, they will prove it. We're skipping everything now, right? There's no earthly intermediary. There's no water intermediary. There's no intermediary symbolic of Torah, right? That's what the walls of the Beit Midrash are. We're going to the source itself. We're going to God. If the law is like me from the heavens, they will prove it. And again, as a reminder, this is at the root of what Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is fundamentally concerned about when he says, I will only say things that I learned from my teachers. Why? He believes in a chain of transmission. What he is trying to do is preserve the word of God in this world. He's not interested in other voices clouding that conversation. A heavenly voice came out and said, what is with you towards Rabbi Eliezer? For the law is like him in every instance. Let's note, by the way, the voice doesn't just say Rabbi Eliezer is right. The voice says, in case we weren't paying attention until now, guys, stop doing this to him. I realize, I being God, kivyachol, that this is about him as a person. Stop. What is wrong with you? He is correct about the law. Rabbi Yeshua stood on his feet and said, it is not in heaven. What does it is not in heaven mean? Rabbi Yirmiyah said, since the Torah was already given at Sinai, we do not pay attention to a heavenly voice. Since you already wrote at Sinai in the Torah, incline after a majority. There is so much to dive into in the way those texts are working here. In context, that is certainly not what it is not in heaven means. It is not in heaven in the context that it is spoken in the book of Devarim, is Moshe saying, I already told you guys the rules. You don't have to send someone back up to heaven to get it again. That actually is a voice in favor of tradition. Here they are taking that text and using it in a radically new way, which makes sense if the point is that these traditions can be taken and reinterpreted. It is not necessarily all about literal transmission. But more importantly here, I think, is that Rabbi Yeshua is finally coming out and saying what the rabbis have been sort of hinting towards all the time, which is, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, we are not willing to adopt your methodology. Your methodology of being the plastered cistern, of the water comes straight from heaven, right? The rain falls and I simply collect it. That's not what we are doing here. We are not simply collecting rainfall. We are not simply collecting what our teachers said. This is a new way of thinking. We are generating in addition to collecting. It is not in heaven. We do not bring proofs from carob trees. We do not bring proofs from miracles. This actually is a different sort of man-made endeavor. We're going to finish up for today at the point where people often end this story. And I want us to keep in mind, this is not the end of the story. We're going to end here on what seems like a triumphant note for the rabbis. What we're going to begin with next week makes the story far darker and more complicated. I want us to hold on for that. Rabbi Natan met the prophet Elijah and said to him, what did God do in that hour? He said to him, he smiled and said, my children have defeated me. My children have defeated me. Let's take a look at that closely before we close up for today, because I want us to recognize two things there. First of all, there's something very lovely about that. God is pleased. God is impressed with God's children who have managed to be so clever. The way that you might be the first time your child beats you at a game of checkers or a game of basketball, whatever your particular sport is. You are proud of your child for stepping into their own, creating their own sphere of independence. That is beautiful. And I want us to pay attention to this word, my children, because if we're saying my children, then there's another relationship going on here, which is that the rabbis are essentially siblings. And a parent might have a lot of pride when their children sort of declare their independence or push back on the parent. But the parent does not feel the same way when the siblings begin to treat each other badly in the name of that project. That's where we're going to jump in next time. We're going to jump into what becomes of this community that we began by asking ourselves, is this a community or a jumble of individuals? And what happens to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, the plastered cistern? We'll jump in there next time. Thank you all so much for joining today, and I'll see you next week. Bye, everyone.